Listening to KBOO Portland.
Lie down all in the ground, I'd root that mountain down, and I wish I was a mole in the ground.
Tune in to KBOO Monday mornings at 9 for the Old Mole Variety Hour, your source for radically democratic news, views, reviews, and interviews, stories of ordinary and extraordinary people working to root down the oppressive institutions of capitalism. That's the Old Mole Variety Hour, Monday mornings at 9.
In the family burial grounds, Howard Lloyd took Frederick to the oldest headstone, dated 1684. As Frederick contemplated that headstone and the long history of enslavement it symbolized, Howard gathered flowers and evergreens. "We made this possible," Frederick thought. Frederick's insight came from the deep fissures of his own body, the culmination of a lifetime of reflection. "My people made all this possible. We built why. We sustained the Lloyd's well through the toil of mechanics, artisans, gardeners. Through our blood, our muscle, our grief, the Lloyd plantation was born and survived. There should be no shame in being here or in saying we came from here. This place made us and we made it. This land is ours too." Frederick and others were given chairs back at the house. They gave views of the garden and the broad walks hedged by flowers and boxes, boxes of flowers and fruit trees. "This is beautiful," whispered Frederick, taking in the moment. Here he was, a former slave who once hid behind bushes to overhear Colonel Lloyd and his neighbors talk, sitting on this same veranda as a distinguished guest. He felt the hot prickling of guilt, for he had been seduced by the beauty before him, made to forget for a moment the agonies and terrors of this place. Then he thought, should beauty or can beauty be denied in such a place? Should such beauty be destroyed to remove any reminder of the cruelties of the past? He imagined future visitors to the Lloyd plantation and guides who would honor the contributions of the enslaved workers. Their names would be listed on walls with the work they did gleaned from the records. Their graves, now in segregated plots, could not be moved. but would be hallowed ground, a silent tribute to the Black builders of Maryland, watered with their tears, enriched with their blood, tilled with their calloused hands.
Good morning, and welcome to the November edition of Black Book Talk. You are hearing the voice of Sidney Morrison, the author of Frederick Douglass, a novel. Sidney, welcome to Black Book Talk.
Thank you so much for the invitation and the opportunity.
Yes. Now, I want to say up front, and then we're going to repeat it near the end, not only are people able to listen to you this morning, but they can see you in person this evening at the Portland Historical Society, 6 p.m. at 1200 Southwest Park Avenue. Can you tell us a little bit about this event?
I'm very honored to be invited by the Oregon Historical Society to talk about Frederick Douglass and his contribution to American life. Frederick Douglass never came to Oregon, and there's no record that he, as far as I know, even referred to Oregon in his work. However, he was very concerned about the treatment of Asians on the West Coast, and he focused on California in the 1860s and the mistreatment of Asians who had been instrumental in completing the Transcontinental Railroad and building the mines. And I know Oregon has a similar history of mistreatment of Asian immigrants. So I look forward to the opportunity of talking about Frederick Douglass's vision of America as a composite nation. And he felt profoundly that America should be the perfect national illustration of unity and dignity of the human family that the world has ever seen. That was his vision of this country. And that's what I want to speak about when I talk to the Oregon Historical Society.
Good morning. So glad to welcome you to Portland. When I was reading this, I was thinking about how I always thought about Frederick Douglass as an abolitionist. I didn't think about him being involved in labor or anything else. And one of the things I learned from reading the book is that he was involved in so many other things other than the freedom from slavery.
Yes. Yes, that in my research was also a discovery that I thought was significant, because over time, although he spoke at first understandably about enslavement and his desire for the freedom of himself and others, he began to see the connection between freedom and justice, not only for the enslaved, but for the treatment of women, for the treatment of laborers, and became progressively more and more universal in his thinking about his role in the 19th century. To some, this was a diminishment of the power of his role as a leader of Black people. And he was criticized, especially by a younger generation of agitators, that by expanding his vision, he was essentially losing focus and weakening the power of the movement. But he believed, on the contrary, that his role was to create connection and allies for universal justice. And this has happened in our history. The same thing happened with Martin Luther King, who expanded his vision beyond Black freedom to issues of labor, justice, and war, and was criticized for it. Frederick Douglass had the same experiences, and it was devastating to him because he felt he had laid the groundwork for the younger generation to even have the opportunity to speak out about issues. But he persisted, and by the end of his life, he was continuing to speak on the behalf of other issues. It is very telling, on the last day of his life, literally the last day of his life, he was at a women's rights convention. Sitting on the stage with Susan B. Anthony, he left the convention and went home to describe what had happened at that convention. And as he was describing it to his second wife, he had a heart attack and died right there at her feet. So for me, Frederick Douglass is significant because not only he articulated the desire for freedom, which I think is a universal desire, but its manifestations expanded beyond just the abolition of slavery, but to create a just society for all people, He said there are such things in the world as human rights. They are eternal, universal, and indestructible. The right of migration, the right which belongs to no particular race, belongs alike to all and all alike. I know of no right of race superior to the rights of humanity. And when there is a supposed conflict between human and national rights, it is safe to go to the side of humanity. He said that in 1869, and he kept on holding to that vision to the very end.
When did you recognize that you were writing this book that took decades to write?
Well, I always wanted to be a writer. I was a storyteller first. And in fact, when I was a child, I played with my sister's dolls because I liked making up stories with the dolls. My sister didn't care for dolls, but I used dolls, I used cards. I even made my siblings perform in plays about history and other things because I loved stories. I even created a series of stories called Planets of the Universe, where we went through different places to discover different worlds. And so by reading books, I realized I wanted to be a storyteller. I loved history. And I remember deciding, listening to my third grade teacher, Mrs. Fisher, that I wanted to be a teacher of history like her, because she was so enthusiastic and so interesting. So I decided I was going to be a history teacher, but I did not conceive myself as a writer until many years later, only because I wasn't sure I had the skills or the technique that justified saying I'm a writer. I could say easily I was a storyteller, or I could say easily I was a teacher. But writer was a little more difficult for me because of the comparisons I made with the great writers like Ellison and Baldwin and Dickens. And that tends to happen with writers. When you see great writers, you think, do you have the right stuff for it? But over the years, I began to realize I was a writer, but writers write. And so I had to produce in order to justify saying I was a writer. And the work that I began first was this novel about Frederick Douglass. In fact, I finished the first version in 1978. I read a dedication to that was this morning, from a friend of a book he gave me on completing that first version. And at first it struck me that it was so long ago, but it stayed with me all this time. And over the years, I continued to feel that this story was worth telling. However, at least in the first two versions, publishers were saying that there was no interest in abolition or slavery or Frederick Douglass. And I disagreed, but that was the market. And then I decided to try it for a third time. And I received an acceptance from a publisher in Portland, Hawthorne Books. And now the book is available. However, I have to tell you, the first time I heard myself described as a writer was by my wife. We were in a computer store and we were trying to get a new computer. And my wife said to the young man, "This is my husband. He's a writer and he needs a computer that really works with writers." I almost fainted. I had never heard her say the word writer or me hearing someone say a writer. And that's when I realized I was truly a writer, because it was now being perceived by other people and acknowledged as well. One of my grandsons, who lives in Portland, when the book was first published, he came up to me and he was about eight at the time. And he said, "Papa, are you an author?" And I just felt, yes, I am an author. I am a writer, I'm an author, and I have to be honest with you, with all the years of which I've been writing this book, only until the last few years am I comfortable with that identity.
Well, you certainly should be. This book to me is fascinating because it's a novel, And that's stated in the title. And yet there is so much factual information. And when I look through the acknowledgments at the end, you have done so much research on this. I mean, certainly you could have released this as a biography with complete credibility, you know, without the fictional areas. But I was wondering, how does that work when you have so much factual information and it's about such a well-known figure? How do you create the dialogues that none of us will, you know, can verify, and yet bring these people to life? I mean, Anna, you know, as the book went on, I thought, this is a strong woman. She's not a pitiful woman. She's a strong woman. She understands the reality of her life. And, you know, she persisted. She prevailed. But how do you do that? You know, what is it? Do the characters speak to you in some way or what?
You may have heard of a historical novelist who's one of my models for historical fiction. She recently passed away. Her name was Hilary Mantel, and she wrote historical novels about Anne Boleyn and Henry VIII, and Thomas Cromwell, who was a minister of Henry VIII. And she said that writing historical novels is like listening to dead people talking. And at a certain point, if you immerse yourself completely in the research, hear these characters talking, and you get to a point, especially for me who love dialogue, that I have to accept that somehow these characters are, through a mysterious force of which I don't completely understand, are so real to me that I hear them talking and I must write it down. I think that only happens, however, if two things take place. And one of them is deep research into the lives and of the times of the characters, number one.
Yes.
And number two, an effort at empathy, which means that you, as a writer of novels, are making an effort to understand essentially the unknown. An unknown time, an unknown place, unknown people. Now, you may, if you're lucky enough to have a record of what people thought and said. And in the 19th century, many people wrote letters and diaries, and Douglas was prolific in his speeches and in his letters, just millions and millions of words. But Anna was illiterate. She never learned to read or write. Frederick wrote three books about his life. But in those three books, which are hundreds and hundreds of pages, he gave her a total of three sentences. So for me, this was a woman who he said was a pillar of his life. But I asked myself, why didn't he speak more about her? Was he embarrassed? Was he ashamed? Was he protecting the privacy of their family? And so I had to do some research to get some background about her. And her daughter, fortunately, wrote a small pamphlet about her mother, which she published privately after both her parents died. And she was afraid that her mother would be forgotten. So she interviewed her before she passed away and got some details about her past, you know, and described how she raised the family and things like this. And I got an insight into the strength of this woman and the perseverance she had and how much she helped Frederick and how courageous it was for a free woman, five years older than this 20-year-old, help him escape. But what was her private thoughts? What were the things she said to Frederick when she was disappointed with him or angry with him or had to justify his behavior to the world or to the neighbors or whatever? That's where I have to add, and I will answer your question. I chose the novel because the novel liberates you from documentation, whereas a biographer has to, with everything they say, validate it with a reference in the evidence. But for a novelist, that is not the case. But the novelist's job is, based on the historical record, create a feeling for the time, for the place, and for the people, so that you will imagine, and that's why it's called a novel, you will imagine the dialogue between Frederick and Anna. You will imagine that, you know, for example, certain things took place, like when Frederick had to meet his family, who found out he had married secretly his secretary. his wife's secretary, and there was a family gathering at the house. We know this because the children said that this happened, this family gathering happened. But for me as a novelist, thinking of the dialogue, what did they actually say? And so I had to go through the records of the letters and take all that and make it into a dramatic telling.
I have to say, you were masterful in that your empathy, because I had some feelings about these other women before. Yes. I read this, but you were empathetic enough that I could understand even if I didn't admire. So you know, I just thank you for that. But the essential truth of the situations and the people were clearly illustrated. The details, whatever. But you know, it just you just came out with something that was so true. But I want to give others a chance to ask you their questions too.
And thank you, Patricia, for identifying what is really the focus of the novelist is the emotional truth. There's a poster right on the window of Powell's in Portland that says, "Just because it's fiction does not mean it's not true."
Exactly.
Fiction tells the truth of the human condition. It's just that you're not shackled by or tied down by the demands of historical documentation. And I'm a historian, so I made sure that the facts of his life were not denied. He was here, he was there, and so thankfully, you're given characters and you're given plot. But the job of the novelist is to go deeper into the emotional life of the characters with an act of empathy. And I'm very pleased to hear that you felt that with all the characters, because I tried to be empathetic towards enslavers, towards people who mistreated Frederick, because everyone has a story and everyone has, you know, feelings, and you try to bring those feelings to life. Unfortunately, when I tried that with all these people, the book was twice as long, and I had to cut many, many pages from it because of that.
I appreciated that you fleshed out Frederick's family and made me think about why his wife, because I'd heard rumors that there were other women in Frederick Douglass's life, and I had wondered how they managed to stay together until she died. So I was thankful to read the novel and imagine a life for him and to know that he had descendants who are around even today.
Yes. Yeah. The of course, families have a different attitude towards this subject, especially if they're a renowned ancestor. They may be even uncomfortable by the suggestion that Frederick had these relationships with other women besides Anna. I try to explore the possibility that maybe this was true. And therefore, if it was true that there were these women in his life, the facts are both of these two white women, Julia Griffiths and Ottilia Assing, both lived with Frederick in the house. That's indisputable. So the question is, what was the relationship between these people? How did they interact? Frederick said very little about this. And of course, Anna said nothing. Julia worked with him in the office in Rochester, and she wrote letters to him between each other for the rest of their lives, even though she moved back to England. Ottilia wrote voluminous letters about Frederick to her sister, and those letters have been translated. And those letters go beyond guessing. Ottilia is quite explicit in her letters to her sister about her relationship with Frederick. The question always goes to in the end, who do you believe? And if you do believe it, how are you going to make it real for the reader? Now, I will not dare to suggest that my novel is a definitive version of Frederick Douglass's life. I'm only saying it's my estimate, my guess of what his life was like. I hope that people will be inspired by my book to go back to the evidence, to biographies, to studies, to explore Frederick Douglass's life more. But I wanted it to be a reading experience that will get people a sense of this remarkable man's complicated life. I'm still trying to figure the man out. After spending all these years, there's an element of mystery still. especially a genius being born in enslavement. He literally was a genius, a literary verbal genius from the very beginning. And how that came into fruition is something that I'm still fascinated in studying.
Did your writing of this novel involve traveling to the original places that you list? You list addresses in here that they lived at. Did you go there?
I did both, but I must say I started with research, going to Washington, going to Frederick Douglass's house, going to the Library of Congress, and then Google came. And thank goodness for Google. Keeps you from having to get physical evidence to the degree that, you know, historians and novelists have had to do. But sir, I will say to you that even though I could get information about like the Eastern Shore or the Chesapeake or the history of Maryland, there is nothing like going there. I just came back from Maryland and saw the Chesapeake for the second time. And when you see it, when you cross that bridge and see the expanse of the Chesapeake, and then you go to the Eastern Shore, you understand why Frederick Douglass loved Maryland. But he did say, it's not that I love Maryland less, I love freedom more. And so, but when you go back to these places like St. Michael's, when I was first there a few years ago, I was like a kid in a candy store because I knew the places where Frederick Douglass stayed and those places were still there. And White House, unfortunately, is closed to the public. It's still in the hands of the family. But to see that physical space and to go back to the town, just recently, for the first time, I was in Easton, which is the town where Frederick Douglass was jailed because he tried to escape and he was caught. And now in front of that courthouse is a statue of Frederick Douglass. And to see that in the flesh just gives me goosebumps now describing it. So what I say to readers is that, yes, research requires a lot of digging through books. And thank goodness we have so many historians who do the work. I have unearthed things that I didn't unearth. So I'm very grateful for biographers and historians. For example, the historian who found the list of the Bailey family. That was an astonishing discovery. And that validated that Frederick Douglass was wrong about his birthday for his entire life. So these people are very important. But for me, I must admit that seeing these places physically makes all the difference. I understood Frederick more because I've been to the places where he lived. I just came back from Rochester. His house was burned to the ground, but to see his burial site, where in that burial site is Frederick, his first wife, and his second wife on each side of him. That is, to me, is something you can't reproduce unless, you know, it's, you can read about it, but being there makes all the difference.
You know something? Your desire to create interest in Douglass and make people want to know more is absolutely going to be validated in me. I am a Baltimore, Maryland born and raised girl. When I was growing up, low these many years after slavery, we didn't know much about the Eastern Shore. Black people did not go generally to the Eastern Shore because of that history. So right. Now I'm thinking, well, what the heck? I have right. to go. Because I was reading, I thought, how could he love this place that has this horrible history? But now, listen to you, I want to go and see it. And I want to thank you. Douglass was a very complex man, brilliant, courageous, determined, worthy of all the attention. That much we know. But you've also showed us the other side. He was a human being.
Frederick Douglass was such a genius, but also a great American who loved this country, who did not love him back in the way that he should have been, but he believed in the dream of America. He believed in freedom for everyone. And so he should be an inspiration, not just for Black people, but for all Americans. I was so taken by Margaret George, a historical novelist who lives in Washington, D.C., and she said to me that she never had visited Frederick Douglass's home on Cedar Hill across the Anacostia River. But because of that book, she went to Cedar Hill and she brought back to me for me a tote bag with a picture of Cedar Hill on it. So each person can have, I hope, if they read the book and they do something to get to know more about this remarkable man, it's to the good.
Sidney Morrison, thank you so much for writing this book. Thank you so much for joining us. Okay, folks, this is the end of the November edition of Black Book Talk. We will be seeing you next month. Good reading to you.
Great reading.
Listening to KBOO Portland, listener-supported community radio. Stay tuned for Shocks of Sheba, up next after these headlines.
Bienvenidos a un breve informativo en su estación comunitaria KBOO 90.7 FM.